On today's episode of The Good Word, Tim Cato from The Athletic joins us to discuss how the Mavericks have rebuilt their team over the last 3 years to get them to this place, Kyrie Irving's history with the city of Boston, and why Derek Lively's perimeter defense could be a major factor in the NBA Finals. All that and much more on today's episode.
Good Word with Goodwill on Yahoo Sports. Ball don't lie. And here is Vince Goodwill.
Welcome to The Good Word. My name is Vincent Goodwill, senior NBA reporter for Yahoo Sports. We are part of the Ball Don't Lie podcast. Get us wherever you get your podcast. It is Monday. We got producer John back on the ones and twos. And because this is finals week, I feel like it would be best, it would be appropriate to bring in my young friend from The Athletic. Maybe not so young because he's turning 30 now, but he's been covering the Mavs for so long that it feels like he is like in his 40s. And that is Tim Cato. He covers the Mavs for The Athletic. He's the host of the Only Mavericks podcast. Tim, how you doing, man?
I'm good. I'm psyched. It's finals week. Headed out to Boston tomorrow. It's my first one. So you're gonna have to show me around a little bit.
Yeah, getting me to show you around Boston will probably be a reality show. I'm gonna be perfectly honest with you. We probably have some different sensibilities. I am certain that all of the rolling finishes to Boston accents will be set this week. That's all I will say. It will be full Boston accents, Tim. Okay.
Like I gotta like hunt them down. Track it's like a Pokemon situation where you gotta find all 150.
Oh no, they're gonna be right there in front of you. As soon as you tell them you're from Dallas, you cover the Mavericks. Of course, you know how everybody thinks. Oh, you cover the team, which means you're a fan of the team, and you have to tell them like, no, I just cover the team. Win or lose, I still get my paycheck. That sort of thing. It will all come out because Kyrie Irving used to play for the Boston Celtics. I'm not sure if you know that, right? Did you know that? Were you aware of that?
I'm just finding out right now. This is incredible.
This is what I'm here for. I'm here to educate the people. The finals, as many of you know, will begin on Thursday in Boston. 1 and 2 will be 2 days in between every game, which means we will have a lot of free time to mill around and hang around Boston. But Tim is here. In large part, Tim, we had to go back and thanks to producer John, who has so much intimate knowledge of Dallas, to like shake my memory. But you and Sam Amick, another friend of the show, you guys combined for two pieces in 2 days, 3 years ago, almost right around this time, when Dallas had just lost in the first round to the Clippers for the second time. Luka had scored 46, and that was Porzingis was there. Tim Hardaway had a big role. Boban Marjanovic was there. And it was Rick Carlisle, Bob Vulgaris, Donnie Nelson. And in one fell swoop, Carlisle stepped down. Donnie Nelson and Bob Vulgaris were in this sort of power struggle. And then a rebuild began. Take me back to that time, because for people who don't remember, that was a very critical point for Luka Doncic and his future with the Dallas Mavericks. And you guys chronicled that.
Yeah, you really even have to take one small step back, even to the Kristaps Porzingis trade. And the whole idea is that teams usually build in a very methodical way when they draft a superstar. You know, Dallas drafted a superstar in Luka Doncic. But usually you have a couple years to still be bad, to realize how good this player is going to be, to have another lottery pick that you can invest, often two lottery picks that you can invest in his future. And Dallas had a problem. Dallas had a few problems. First was a good problem, was that Luka was so good so quick that they saw the ability to just instantly try to go get his running mate. They took their shot with Kristaps. Because they had fallen in the lottery and had to trade back up to get Luka, they had already shipped away, you know, the following first round pick that ended up, you know, famously that was in the you know, Atlanta traded for that in the Cam Reddish trade. They got in the Trae Young trade, they got Cam Reddish. But Kristaps wasn't working. You know, like that was just not a you know, he was not the player he has been for Boston. He needed that time to kind of reinvent himself, to improve, and to accept that he wasn't, you know, a 1B, that he is a 2 or a 3 on a championship team. That's what we've seen in Boston. I don't think he ever would have been that in Dallas. And so going into that Clippers series, it was a repeat. You know, Dallas had lost to them in 2020. They lost again in 2021. And it was really unclear the direction that they were going to go. Clearly, as we've seen, it took somebody different coming in and saying, this is not working. Let's trade Kristaps. Let's, you know, go through the cycle of moves that we're about to talk about. That was needed. But there was all these power dynamics. There was Vulgaris obviously coming in. And, you know, really it was a Mark Cuban issue.
Mm-hmm.
Mark had let this guy come in and have unclear amount of powers within the organization, to the point that the front office felt like it couldn't do its job, that, you know, there's frustrations directed back at Bob. You know, Bob wasn't sure what his role was. It was all coming from Mark, and he had allowed things to just kind of go on and go on and go on. And so finally it all came to a head. There was, you know, all this stuff was going to happen, whether my article came out or not. But, you know, obviously I'd been hearing about it for months. Me and Sam Amick, we published that. And then there's Donnie's departure. Rick leaves shortly after that. And as we talk through how Dallas actually rebuilt this, I think the most important thing is that Mark Cuban, you know, now just the minority owner of the team, he let Nico Harrison and he let Jason Kidd do their jobs in a way that he never really let Donnie Nelson kind of operate that way. And so that, to me, is like the critical backbone, the spine to how this whole thing has happened over the past few years.
Yeah, and I want to stick with Jason Kidd and Nico Harrison for a minute, because for those who don't know, Nico Harrison was big time Nike executive. All the connections in the world, you can see it on all the shoes that he has, because I try to play shoe wars with Nico, which never really works out well because his shoe bag is deeper than mine. Whenever I see him, even when I think I got him beat, I don't have him all the way beat. It's like you win by decision as opposed to a knockout. But Nico wasn't in the traditional basketball cycle of player personnel, scout, assistant GM, then GM. He came from a completely different world. And Jason Kidd had been fired in the middle of a season with the Milwaukee Bucks. And then the Milwaukee Bucks immediately became a 60-win team in the next full season after he left. So take me back to that time, because from my distance and remembrance, a lot of people were wondering, is this combination, because they were almost hired, I feel like they were hired the same day, the remembrance of what the skepticism or lack of optimism that there might have been around both of those hires at the same time?
Yeah, for sure. There was some skepticism. There was speculation about how they would fit. Nico Harrison, you know, he took a little bit of time to adjust to the job. You know, this is something I heard throughout his first season, that, you know, there was speculation around the league about whether, you know, just that he was green, that he was figuring things out. But so they technically hired, or they announced Nico before they announced Jason Kidd. My understanding of the situation is they're always going to hire Jason Kidd. You know, that was something that, you know, everybody around the team, and, you know, in one of the very rare instances that Dirk Nowitzki actually exerts his influence and, you know, whatever advisor role he has, which is basically, hey, we're going to pay you money for those discounts you took over the years. You know, Dirk wanted him. Michael Finley wanted Jason Kidd back. You know, this pretty much everybody around Cuban felt like Jason Kidd was the guy to hire. And then they found Nico Harrison, who, you know, certainly was on their radar, certainly had front office speculation before.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it had ever been super serious as a full GM job. And that's obviously what allowed him to finally make the leap. But absolutely, he had front offices inquire before. And he was someone who had a very long relationship with Jason Kidd. And so once you knew it was going to be Kidd, that's when they go and target, you know, Nico Harrison. They certainly looked at more traditional routes. Dennis Lindsay, who's now an advisor to the team, was somebody who was on their list even at the time. But that's the choice they made. You know, they announced it in the way they did. They, you know, they hired Sportsology, which is like this consulting firm, and all this. But yeah, it was Jason Kidd, and then it was Nico, and both needed some time to kind of grow into the position. Absolutely. But, you know, you can't really argue with the results when they're, you know, in the NBA finals as they are this week.
I think it's funny. I think those Sportsology, those consulting firms or search firms, they just stealing money. You tell them who you want to hire. They tell you to hire the person. So therefore you have a buffer. You say, we didn't hire him. The search firm did it. Just take accountability and hire who you want to hire. I just think that's kind of goofy. But
yeah,
you touched on something with Nico, and I think people accept that Nico, coming from the Nike world, it was going to take a little while for him to adjust. I think with coaches is different. We have our minds made up about these guys. Like, if they come in and they're good, then they're immediately a genius. If they're not, they're a boob, or he's just a player's guy, or whatever the label is. I feel like Jason Kidd is by far nowhere near the coach that he was when he was doing the hit me in Brooklyn, to, you know, because he didn't have any timeouts. Nor is he the guy in Milwaukee that was better, but didn't quite know how to handle all aspects, you know, of the job. But the one thing I do remember with Jay and Milwaukee that I thought was really going to fare well was he turned Giannis into a point guard, which meant he put the ball in Giannis's hands all the time and was going to make Giannis this, like, decision maker. You can see the floor from the top. You're going to go end to end. I felt like in some ways with Luka Doncic, that kind of prepared Jason to be able to coach a guy. Although they're not similarly built, they do have offenses built around their unique skills. And I felt like that created or fostered a connection between the two.
Yeah, no, Jason Kidd is a completely different type of person, to my understanding. You know, I wasn't obviously around him closely in past years, but my understanding is, you know, like, this is who he's been in Dallas is just so different. You know, there is a, what's the right way to put this? Like, you know, not to psychoanalyze and, you know, this is a story that at some future point, you know, maybe I'll have the ability to tell, but it almost seems like an inner peace. There is absolutely a patience. And I think if there's one thing he learned coaching Giannis and being around superstars, it is the patience. And Mavericks fans were really mad at Jason Kidd last season. And look, that season was a disaster. You know, completely missing even the play-in tournament is a disaster. But what Mavericks fans really got mad at were quotes like, you know, I'm not playing, I'm just sitting here watching just like you. You know, he would say stuff like he had no control over the game. And I get in the moment how that's frustrating, but I think his approach has become more clear as time has gone on, that you only have so much control over a superstar. Right. A superstar right. like Luka is going to do what he wants.
Right.
And changing him and helping him improve is a process that takes years. And we've seen it in small ways. This is the best defensive season Luka's ever had. He's been mostly, you know, average to good defensively throughout this postseason run. When the season started, you know, these Luka teams have always been super slow paced, because when you can do what he does in the half court, why wouldn't you be?
Right.
You know, why risk losing that control by just like trying to run all the time? Jason Kidd got through to Luka. He got him to look for those big, long outlet quarterback throwing passes to start possessions. The pace was top 10 in the regular season. That is an asset, that is a facet of the Mavericks offense that has really benefited them this season. And so it's been slow, and it has taken patience. But I think you can see that throughout Jason Kidd's approach, specifically for Luka, that, you know, this is just somebody who understands that, you know, it's not all going to happen at once, and it hasn't, and there was pitfalls, and there was moments where it looked pretty bad, but, you know, Western Conference Finals twice in 3 years, now an actual finals, that the results clearly are there.
Yeah, and I want to, like, it's so weird when people looked at that 2022 thing as like some level of anomaly, when they clearly, after not having their feet under them the first two games against the Phoenix Suns, they clearly were the better team from that point on. And they have won a lot of games. They have basically won the first round without Luka Doncic at full strength or even present for a few games in that series.
Won so twice you have to, with it, without him even on the court, yeah.
Right. So like, so then there's this Jalen Brunson thing. And Jalen Brunson, you know, develops and he's like, oh, this is a guy that can be Luka's co-star. And then they, you know, because he doesn't come to contract agreement before the start of that season before that, you know, he's an unrestricted free agent, could go wherever he wants to go. He goes to the Knicks, you know, the World Wide West CAA connection. That's an obvious one. Do you think, were you at that point, as we're sort of chronologically going through stuff, did you think that would be the death knell blow to, you know, this whole thing building around Luka? Even, you know, they signed him to the extension shortly after, but how did you perceive the Jalen Brunson, you know, emergence and then subsequent departure?
Oh, absolutely. I remember telling people at the time when Brunson left that if Luka leaves, it's all going to be traced back to this point. And there was never concerns about Luka leaving. There was never, you know, Luka was never looking outside past his extension, any of this stuff. The concern was within the front office and the concern was with superstars. We understand that they hold the power. And that if Dallas was going to, you know, if Dallas had another season, a repeat of last season, you know, if they were to, you know, I don't think it's super realistic that Dallas was going to, you know, completely miss the play-in tournament. It took a lot for that to happen.
Right.
But you have two unsuccessful seasons in a row. That's when the doubt starts creeping in for someone like Luka. And I thought at the time that Jalen Brunson left that could be something that really affected them. And, you know, mistakes were made. Several mistakes were made. You know, it was a mistake to even allow him to sign him to a contract as a second round pick that allowed him to be an unrestricted free agent. They could have signed him in a way that he becomes restricted. They have control over his rights. It was a mistake from Nico Harrison and the new front office not to sign him before the season to, you know, what would have been the best contract in the NBA given who he developed into.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was certainly a mistake. And, you know, that's a mistake that I think also reflects on Mark, because he hired a first time new GM who was figuring out the ropes, who, you know, wasn't sure exactly how he was going to reshape this team and wasn't willing to commit to this. And then, yes, it was a mistake not signing him when he went to New York, just from a talent, you know, management standpoint. But I think, you know, baked all into this is that if Jalen Brunson had resigned in Dallas, maybe he's playing in Brooklyn, not New York, because he's getting shipped out in the Kyrie deal. Now, Dallas would have retained some, you know, better, you know, they would have retained Dorian Finney-Smith. They would have retained first rounders. There's other ways that they could have improved the team. Obviously, looking back, Jalen Brunson ended up where he needed to go. Dallas ended up, you know, getting Derek Lively in the draft. All stuff. I'm stepping on your toes. That's all
no,
stuff
no,
we'll,
no,
we'll get
no,
to.
No, go ahead. No, no,
but
no.
But that was a big reason why, you know, Jalen Brunson, I think, understood that he was not valued the same way that he felt he should be.
Right.
And that he felt his game could go. And he certainly proved that. And it looked for a minute like a death knell. And then Dallas had to find some ways to acquire talent by letting Brunson just walk out the door. They had to find ways to acquire talented players at less than the cost that you would usually see associated with a team in its position. And that's what happened over the next couple of years.
And that's where Kyrie Irving comes in. And exactly. You just said something really interesting, because you said maybe Jalen Brunson winds up playing in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
I'm not putting words in your mouth. I'm just asking for clarity's sake. Do you think where Kyrie was as a depreciated asset, you know, in Brooklyn, you know, not playing at the moment and everything else. And you hit the vaccine stuff, you had the injury stuff, you had, you know, the Twitter stuff or, you know, the Amazon video, all of that type of stuff. Do you still think Nico Harrison makes the trade for Kyrie Irving and giving up Jalen Brunson to do it? just off the strength of the relationship, do you think that trade still happens even if they retain Jalen Brunson?
I think it's possible. I mean, obviously, there's no way to prove something that, you know, didn't even have a chance to happen in
right,
the end.
Right.
But I think it's possible. I think that Nico Harrison is someone who values, who clearly valued Kyrie Irving and valued him in a different way than Jalen Brunson. At the time, that was perfectly valid, you know?
Mm-hmm.
That's not, you know, I think they made a mistake with Jalen Brunson to an extent, but, and I do think Jalen Brunson would have kept getting better in Dallas, even playing next to Luka. But yes, Jalen Brunson, who he is in New York, is different than Jalen Brunson, who he was in Dallas. That's an obvious statement, but it's worth a reminder. I do think that quite possibly they end up making that trade, but like I said, it's impossible to know for sure.
Right, right.
But I do know that Kyrie Irving and that type of stardom is that type of talent is something that Nico Harrison values that in a different way than I think past, you know, the past front office of Dallas. And he was always going to be incentivized to go and try to acquire a player like that.
Well, here's the crazy thing about Nico. For someone who is quote unquote green compared to some of the more experienced executives, compared to the Tim Connollys and, you know, even Brad Stevens, who's been in his chair for a minute, he's going to get off of a player or off of a situation really quickly if he notices that it's not working. You know what I mean? You trade the first and Grant Williams, who you signed over the summer to get PJ. You trade the first to get Daniel Gafford. Like, you know, signing Derrick Jones Jr. and signing Dante Exum. Like, they, and then also don't forget the clandestine, we're going to hold a workout, secret workout for Derek Lively the second, and we're going to draft him 12th in a move that I'm not sure a lot of people at the time were saying, oh yeah, this is a great draft, you know, for them. It was kind of like, oh, this kid is young and he's athletic, but it's going to take him a minute. But just getting back to Nico as a whole, remaking this roster after missing the play-in, purposely missing the play-in last year, I think that's one of the more, I guess, undersold and under-talked about stories about not only is this team different from 2022, they're built different and they have a completely different dynamic, even though Luka is the constant.
Yeah, and Nico showed this right away. You know, he was in the job for, you know, all of 6 months when he traded Kristaps. And yes, he was green and there was, you know, probably mistakes early on that he made because of that. But he also has a different view of the NBA, one that I think has benefited him a lot. I was talking to PJ Washington's dad and, you know, did a story on The Athletic about, you know, how him and Daniel Gafford had played against each other in AAU since they were kids, since at least, you know, ninth grade. And I think they had played against each other even further dating back from that. Nico Harrison watched them play mm-hmm. AAU together.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he has that different perspective. I think probably the most impressive move that Nico has made in my eyes is the PJ Washington trade, because he identified someone who was not playing defense in Charlotte. Really wasn't. He really was not playing much defense this year, last season in Charlotte. He was struggling. He was in a role that he didn't understand. His stats were suffering as a result. And he identified this guy as someone who can completely change and morph into a role that fits next to Luka Doncic, and he can play defense again. And that all of these reasons, all of these issues that, you know, or these shortcomings, you know, him not being 100% of the player he could be in Charlotte, that was because of Charlotte. And that in Dallas next to Doncic, things would be different. And that comes, at least by his own words, that comes from this history he has with them and just the familiarity he has with players, not for the 5 years PJ Washington has been in the NBA, but, you know, really the 10 years he's been a professional basketball player or on the rise to professional basketball player. And that has really served Nico well.
Man, it's so weird because I live in Detroit, where Troy Weaver is now the deposed, you know, general manager, now replaced by Trajan Langdon, who's going to have complete control of basketball operations. And one of Troy's strengths in the beginning was his grassroots connections, you know, to the AAU world, to seeing guys play when they were 15, 16 years old, and not judging them solely by maybe whatever foundational struggles that they've had and, you know, their first stops, you know, the Marvin Bagleys, the James Wisemans. It hasn't worked out. So while I think having those connections is very important for Nico, is also being able to see beyond that and seeing I'm not going to hold his team's culture against him. I know his character, and his character is going to enable him to come in here. Because bringing in two guys from losing situations, Tim, and having them assimilate themselves into winning, and not only that, but having them bolster your defense and change the complexion of your team chemistry, like that's something you almost never hear of losing players on losing teams, two of them at the same time coming into a team that's trying to figure stuff out. Tim, you normally don't see that.
But that's also what you have to do when you have your, you know, Jalen Brunson walk out the door and you get nothing back in return. Mm-hmm. You have to capitalize on situations like this. You know, Boston did it with Kristaps, who was also in Washington. Boston was in a different position. But, you know, when you are cash strapped and when the salary cap is, you know, something that you've got to work around, sometimes you've got to say, hey, this guy who is putting up numbers but isn't affecting winning due to the players around them, they can thrive here. You know, that's what they did with KP, and that's what Dallas did with PJ Washington, Daniel Gafford. You know, there's no doubt in my mind, I don't know how much, but that PJ Washington and Daniel Gafford have higher value. You know, if Dallas were to, for whatever reason, you know, in this hypothetical scenario this summer, they were to try to shop them, you'd have to imagine they have higher value than they did when they came here. And that's the type of thing that overcomes a mistake like letting Jalen Brunson go. And that's how you get back into the black, essentially, when you're working from a team building position that is not advantageous, that was never advantageous, because Luka was fortunately and unfortunately so good so fast that you didn't really have time to even build around him.
Not just that, but he has such a specialized game that, because like you said, you talk about the pace, you talk about Luka being this guy who, because he sees the floor so well, because he can control the game in a certain way, it takes the right type of superstar or right type of superstar talent to play next to that guy and to be able to thrive and for those players to work in concert. And that's where Kyrie Irving might be, like the profile of a Kyrie Irving might be the most ideal number two that you can have in a league, because you don't necessarily want him to be your best player. But there's not many players better than him that you would have next to your best player. Like, he can kind of fit in anywhere with his skill, the style in which he plays. You know what I mean? Like, aesthetically, it's pleasing, but it's also very, very efficient and effective. And last year, it just seemed like a little rocky, like both sides were trying to not step on each other's toes and figure it out. This year, they found a complete rhythm with each other, with the way they would take turns in a good way during the Western Conference Finals. Kyrie would take over the first quarter of game one, and then Luka takes over the fourth quarter of game one, and then, you know, they flip it in game two. Like, that sort of thing. Like, how long did it take? Just the full season of familiarity? Or is this just Kyrie being able to fit in with virtually anybody?
Yeah, this is definitely the smoothest it's been. And I think Kyrie, I think you're right. Like, Kyrie can fit in with anybody. And In that way, he's even more of a seamless fit than Luka, with Luka, just since we keep bringing up Jalen Brunson. I do think Kyrie is a slightly better fit.
I think he's a wholly better fit.
Yeah.
Think he's a markedly better fit, because, not to cut you, Jalen Brunson just demands so much usage and demands so much space on the floor, because he's not blown by anybody. He's going to dip his shoulder. He's going to take up time on the shot clock. I don't see how that hurt or helps when Luka is kind of the same thing, except Luka's just better and bigger. Like, you needed someone like Kyrie who can just go straight line to the basket and do it very quickly and efficiently.
By chance, I'm trying to remember.
No, I'm not a wrong black guy. I don't know.
Unbelievable.
Who you got me confused with?
So back in the 90s and in the 2000s, the 4-4-2 formation was real popular, and you would play two strikers up top, and usually you'd have a big guy and a small guy. You'd have the big guy who's, like, you know, up there to head the ball onto the quicker, shorter guy who's running past. And that's one of many ways that I kind of think about this duo, is that they play statistically very similarly, like if you were to just put like dots on the floor, like, you know, like those tracking simulations, they're both going to be running spread pick and rolls with the five coming to screen for them and the other guy's going to be in the corner. But the way they do it is so different. Like, Luka is this enormous guy, and he can, you know, even someone like Jaden McDaniels last series looks small against him.
Yes, he did.
Whereas Kyrie Irving is doing it in a completely different way, way quicker, way smaller, way craftier, you know, has, you know, Luka's underrated part of Luka's game is how good his handle is. But, you know, Kyrie's obviously are, you know, the best in the league, you know, some of the best we've ever seen. And, yes. And he's just, you know, so that it really keeps defenses off balance. And there's just such a contrast between the stylistic way that you have to defend these exact same actions. And, you know, I think last season it wasn't as not smooth as maybe people made it out a little bit. It was really just the defense and everything else around it. But this season, I absolutely agree that they have found like a synergy to playing together that has really made this whole thing hum.
No, we're going to get into the muck and sort of the minutia of the finals, like right after the break. But I do want to just quickly go through how impressive this playoff run has been. Like, we think of Denver last year. Denver's playoff run last year was dominant, but they beat an 8, they beat a 4, and they beat a 7 or something like that. And then they beat an 8 in the finals, if I remember correctly. Those were the seeds, because the Heat were the 8 seed, the Lakers were a 7. You know, Phoenix was a 4-5. Dallas has beat 3 teams in this playoff run that all had realistic designs on getting to the finals. The Clippers were desperate to get to the finals. You know what I mean? That's why Ty Lue's contract wasn't done. Paul George's contract wasn't done. Kawhi Leonard's contract was done, but they were of the belief that he was going to get there. Oklahoma City, everybody tends to believe that they will continue to sort of knock on the door, but they were the best team in the Western Conference. And then Minnesota, after they knocked off Denver, we were all ready to crown Minnesota as the team that was going to the finals. Tim, this is one of the most impressive runs of beating championship teams on the way to the finals that I've seen probably since the 95 Rockets. And you might not even have been alive when the 95 Rockets did what they did.
I was 2.
Okay, there we go.
Yeah. But I was watching.
Of course.
I was watching for sure. I was a year and a half, and I was locked in, man. So to your point, you know, not a lot of fifth seeds go to the NBA finals, you know, like it's as simple as that. Now, mm-hmm. This may start happening more and more as parity. You know, we are in an era of parity, and a team that's fifth is clearly, and in Dallas's case, is as good. But Dallas also will point to their regular season, and anybody on the team will tell you, I've had this conversation several times. They will say that the fifth seed is not representative of the regular season they felt like they had.
Right.
Both the run they went on after the trade deadline, but also, you know, when we talk about Luka and Kyrie, some of the worst stretches this team went through was ones where Kyrie was injured. You know, Luka was mostly healthy most of the year, but Kyrie certainly missed some time, and they understood that even when they traded for him. You know, I don't think Nico Harrison, if you were to sit down with him, would pretend otherwise, you know, that this was a player that had some availability concerns. But I think he shares that patience that Jason Kidd has, and he understands that, you know, his job is to get talent that maximizes the ceiling of this team, not the floor of this team. And so right now you're seeing the ceiling. Everything's coming together. And, you know, yes, there were some low points even within the season. You know, obviously it took the trade deadline for them to really flesh out this vision that Jason Kidd had of the team. But this team's ceiling clearly is way far higher, you know, than even their record shows.
Yeah, I mean, they won 51 games. Like, just being a fifth seed, the West was just so stacked in such a way. Like, remember,
if they think they could have been like a 6, like a 58. I don't want to put exact numbers on it. Nobody's saying numbers to me, but they easily think they could have been a top 1 or 2 seed.
I mean, look, if you just extrapolate on, you know, going 24-10, you know, from February 1st to the end of the season, with the way that they played defense. And that once that defense came around, that took a lot of pressure off of Luka to feel like he had to do everything on offense. Like, no game was out of reach. I think that's the thing that I've learned watching this team in a playoff setting is that down 13 to Minnesota in game one, come back with no problem. Down 18 to Minnesota in game two, you never feel like they're out of the game because their defense will do just enough, if not just be all right, excellent, but they'll do just enough to keep a game within reach. And then boom, if Kyrie goes on a heater, you're back in it. Luka goes on a heater, you're back in it. It doesn't take that much. And I think that's what makes this series in itself pretty intriguing, which we're going to talk about right after we pay some bills from these ads. Welcome back to The Good Word, here with Tim Cato of The Athletic. Tim, the finals begin on Thursday. I'm expecting a lot of spread pick and rolls on both sides, a lot of switching, a lot of we're going to put Derek Lively and Daniel Gafford in the action on one side of the floor and then bring them on the other action on the other side of the floor. Like, this is going to be one of those coaching strategy series because I don't feel like either team has a decided advantage. I know people think Boston has a talent advantage, maybe top to bottom, and perhaps they do. But I see this being, if my best player is better than your best player, I got a better chance than you.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, how many times have we seen that play out exactly like that? I think the series is fascinating, and I was really going through it last night trying to figure out how I feel it's going to play out on both sides of the court. One thing that really stands out to me is that both teams challenge a core part of each other's identity. So for Dallas and the Dallas offense, Boston's defense does not double team. They don't send blitzes. They sent the second fewest the entire regular season. The only team that sent fewer blitzes, like sent doubles off these picks, was Detroit. Maybe Detroit should have tried doubling a little bit more. So Boston has this idea that every time, like, they have so many good perimeter defenders that they're going to switch as much as possible. They're going to play drop coverage. You know, they're going to get you into one-on-ones. They're not going to give you 4-on-3 basketball against Luka Doncic. Sometimes he just makes you do that. You know, we saw that in game 5, right? You know, the closeout game against Minnesota.
Yep.
There was nothing you could do but double him. There was literally no other option. And so that identity for Boston is either they're going to have to commit to switching, and that includes at times Al Horford and Kristaps Porzingis. You know, you can hide those guys on Derek Jones Jr., but maybe if Maxey gets in the game, he's more of a pick and pop threat. You may just have to switch even the big men. You know, and you may have to switch Sam Hauser. You may have to switch Derek White, who, as good of a defender he is.
He's lighting the pants, baby. Light work.
Yeah, maybe. Well, Luka might look at that guy and be like, you're too small.
Yep, you know,
you're too short. You might do the little too short thing. So on the other side of the court, Dallas's identity is that they always stay at the rim. You know, they always have help protection there. They're going to find a shooter. They're going to sag off of them. Can you do that with Boston? I'm not so sure. This is probably the best shooting team of all time. Is that crazy to say?
That's crazy. That's insane to say, Tim Cato.
That's probably crazy to say. What I will say is it's the best spaced team of all time. Best shooting team, let's talk about like the ceiling of like those Warriors teams, stuff like that. You know, the KD, Curry,
yes.
Warriors.
Yes, there we go.
But
there we go.
Spacing, just every single player who will play in the series for Boston can make threes. And every single player will take 8 of them. That's not something Dallas has run into, you know, throughout this entire playoff series. Yes, Oklahoma City was a 5-out space team. Chet Holmgren was taking like 3 threes a game. You know, he wasn't a threat in the same way. And, you know, certainly there was other players that Dallas kind of dared to shoot at times. Against Boston, I'm just not sure you can do that. And so I think both of those identities and who kind of wins or gets the upper hand will kind of define the series. And I do think both of these identities being challenged in these certain ways probably benefits the offense on both sides. As much as we talk about the defenses, I think these are going to be pretty high scoring, pretty efficient offensive games. For the winning team in any given outcome.
Well, the crazy thing is, I don't want this to turn into like the 3-point shootout, but it just might, right? Like,
yeah, modern NBA, baby.
I hate it. I hate it. I hate 53-point shots in the game. This is not the NBA I used to love. But we're here, right? You brought up something really interesting. First, I'm going to start with Dallas's offense. I felt like in game 5, and we're going to go a little bit in the weeds here. I feel like in game 5, Dallas started setting their screens so high up on the floor for Luka that it was like, you guys can't run around the floor as quick as we can move the ball around the floor. If you're going to blitz us, we are setting the screen damn near at half court. You can't cover 40 feet of space with three guys or two guys and everybody in rotation. And we're going to just, you know, get you open shots that way. I feel like that's a strategy that they're going to try to replicate against Boston. Whether Boston switches or blitzes, even though Boston doesn't blitz, they feel like they can switch everything. I feel like Luka can still hunt Derek White Jr. He can still, Derek White. He ain't no
Too many Derek's on the series.
Yeah, it's a lot of Derek's. It's a lot
Adam
of Derek's.
Silver, you got to do something about this.
I mean, what are you going to do? What are you going to run the hospitals and say, change it, change that baby's name?
I don't know. There's something. I'm not the commissioner. I'm just saying something needs to be done.
Well, we will get Tim's thoughts on what makes a better NBA world at the end of this podcast. But I think Luka can hunt. I won't say he'll hunt Jaylen Brown, but I feel like he can wear Jaylen Brown down offensively by making him accountable defensively. You know what I mean? And like you said, the Horfords, the Sam Housers, even the Porzingis, even when he's out there, assuming that he's all the way right. Like, I don't feel like there's any matchup that Luka wouldn't be comfortable in if he found himself there.
Yeah, I mean, Jaden McDaniels didn't make him look uncomfortable even for a moment.
No, he didn't.
You know, when you talk about, you know, defenders with size who can actually bother Luka, and that's all you're trying to do. You're just trying to bother him and annoy him. You know, certainly Drew Holiday is probably a better shout than, you know, Jaylen Brown or Derek White. And then Tatum. Tatum is like-sized with Luka. And so I think that's where a lot of it's going to come. I mean, Boston's big question is kind of, I think they can win either path. And so those two paths are, they can just start doubling him and they can get better at that throughout the course of the series. But they don't do that a lot. Like, there's going to be some in-series learning if that's what they choose to do. Or they can single him. But I think if they choose to just switch everything, to let him score one-on-one, that has to be something they commit to for the entirety of this series. I think it's a huge disadvantage if Boston kind of panics, if Dallas gets a game and Boston panics and switches halfway through. Because the whole idea of saying, hey, Luka, we understand, like, you know, we're going to switch out, you know, whoever you want and you're going to have to score on them. The idea is to wear him out over the course of the series. And unless you really commit to that, what's the point of doing it? Like, but you're not going to play traditional, you know, drop coverages.
Right.
You know, Luka is the best alive at solving that. You know, you talked about these screens that they're setting for him literally, you know, almost literally at half court. You know, yeah, okay, just swim under it. And all of a sudden, Luka's hitting that shot too, you know, like with range that is 30 plus feet. So he's the hardest perimeter player in the NBA to guard. And I, you know, do not have any jealousy of the Boston staff trying to figure that out, even with the defense they have.
Well, now we have to flip it, right? And you brought up the Celtics being, you said it was blasphemous when you said it. You know, John is going to, like, literally blurt it out as if you cursed. I'm going to make John do that because I don't want the world to view Tim Cato as some conspiracy theorist. But you said that Boston might be the shooting team you've ever seen. And I will say to you, Klay Thompson might have been the best shooter in the world, but wasn't the best shooter on his own team in 2017, right? All right, cool. But I say that to say, pressure at the rim was how Golden State started to initially facilitate space. Steph could get to the rim. KD could get to the rim. Draymond, before Draymond got the yips, and I think in that third year, he was putting pressure on the rim, and that caused defenses to sort of overhelp, swing, you get shots. Boston doesn't have that level of athleticism to get pressure to the rim. They're just trying to get that three-point shot. They're just trying to work there. How does that affect Lively and Gafford in the space that they're, you know, because that was the big problem against Minnesota. Anthony Edwards couldn't find the space to really explode. That's why when he dunked on Gafford that one time, it felt so cathartic because he never had the runway to actually get to the rim.
Yeah, that dunk came, you know, in Anthony Edwards' best stretch.
Yeah.
And it came after Derek Lively went out with, you know, that nasty, mm-hmm, scary, mm-hmm, injury that turned out to be all good. Derek Lively is this team's best center. He's probably their third most important player.
Was it you, Tim, who told me we were sitting somewhere, and maybe I don't know if it's a press room or something like that, and you asked me if Derek Lively was a top 60 player in the league?
I think I said 75, but yes, that was me. He is.
I was going to actually give you credit. I was actually going to say the more I thought about it, it doesn't sound so crazy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's that effective. He's sensational. Yeah. I think he's going to be the center for the series. Daniel Gafford has had issues getting out to shooters. Really good player, really good center. You know, this is just such a unique matchup. Mm-hmm. You know, if you know, okay, you're right. Not the best shooting team of all time. But the spacing is just something different to account for. Derek Lively, what's funny is he wasn't really they didn't really use him as a switcher a lot of the regular season. You know, in fact, one of the most notable examples was actually against Boston in the regular season. But this was something that they wanted to ease him into. You know, he's a rookie. They wanted to bring him along the right way. They didn't want a moment where, you know, some guard gets onto him and crosses him over and Derek Lively kind of hits the floor. And, you know, like they were protecting him even from that, which is the smart thing to do for a 19-year-old. Well, Lively's 20 now. He is, you know, as he will say, he's not a rookie anymore because he's in the postseason. And like they have utmost trust in him. They're having him switch on to anyone. You know, he guarded Paul George and Kawhi in the first round. You know, he guarded at times Shea. He guarded Anthony Edwards and did a capable job. So I do think this is going to be a big, big series for Derek Lively. And I think, you know, Daniel Gafford, we'll see if he can adjust, if he can make the adjustments he needs to be capable. Dallas certainly wants to rotate those guys as much as possible, but they also have Maxi Kleber as another option who, you know, he's going to play the four next to Lively a lot, but you know, if they need to, that could also be the team's backup center or starting center, or, you know, whatever you want to call it. He could enter into that center rotation even while Lively's getting the bulk of the minutes.
Yeah. I mean, look, Jason Tatum can dunk over you, but he's not going to really blow by somebody to clear the runway like Anthony Edwards. Jaylen Brown's a little more athletically and kind of a lot more athletically inclined, I suppose. But, you know, sometimes you have to worry about him not bringing the ball with him to the rim. Like he might lose it somewhere like 15 feet back. Even though, no, Jaylen Brown has played excellent basketball. Like all jokes aside, he's played excellent. Tatum has played.
I voted him third team All-NBA, I think.
Did you?
I recall. Yeah. Yeah, I thought he was that good.
He was the one omission I had. And the reason he was an omission is because I like, you know, all NBA teams to look like teams and not just collections of players.
It's valid.
You know what I mean?
A traditionalist.
Not rigid traditionalist, Tim, but I used at least the model of two front court or two back court, three front court.
Yeah.
And it was pretty much between Jaylen Brown and Devin Booker. And because we haven't seen Book play in 2 months, it's kind of easy to forget how good a guy is and all this other type of stuff. But all that being said, we've brought up Kyrie a little earlier in the sense of how he's fit next to Luka. But Kyrie is now going into Boston where, as I said before, and Tim was just notified of this, he was traded to Boston from Cleveland and played a couple years there. There's the whole stepping on Lucky. There's the whole burning the sage with the walking stick. There's the whole, you know, I want to stay here and then I'm going to leave. And there's so much history there and it's ugly, right? And Kyrie hasn't played particularly well when he's played in Boston since leaving Boston, most notably that playoff series with the Brooklyn Nets in 2021 or 22. I lose track of the years. I think it was 22. Because 21 was the year where if Kyrie's ankle doesn't turn against Milwaukee, the Brooklyn Nets win the championship. Hot take, correct, right? How do you think Kyrie handles the specter of this, the enormity of this entire series going back to Boston?
Yeah, I mean, that's going to be the storyline, man. And if he has a bad game one, like everybody's going to be talking about it and writing about it and asking questions about it. You know, I know, you know, I don't know the, you know, the time and Kyrie had in Boston, like national writers who are, you know, more locked in on it. Certainly not as much as the fan base. And, you know, I know enough that they have a reason to dislike him and just to dislike his behavior specifically when he was there. Totally understand that. All I have to say is that at this point of his career, you know, Kyrie is, you know, nothing like that player who I've seen described, you know, when he was in Boston and then obviously later in Brooklyn, you know, nothing like that. And yeah, sure. In the regular season, you know, when Dallas made their one trip to Boston, he missed a bunch of shots in that game. And you could say he was rushing it or that, you know, the, you know, all the history and the baggage came back to bite him. You could say that. You could also just say that he had a bad shooting night. You know, this is someone who has, you know, I said inner peace with Jason Kidd, and that's a big word. You know, I don't want to be making huge sweeping statements about, you know, people and what they're
actually feeling. I feel like that's appropriate, yeah. Tim. I really do. I feel like that's
I think it is for Kyrie. I think it really is for Kyrie. Like he's got kids, you know, younger mm-hmm. kids. He's, you know, they were palling around outside a press conference he did after game four and, you know, making noises and he was, you know, kind of looking over and checking in on them and then answering questions and, you know, going long and detailed with reporters about, you know, just his thoughts on his career. He hasn't really touched the Boston stuff. That's true. And I think he's probably going to, you know, if we see a slightly different Irving, you know, I'm very curious how he handles all the questions at media day. I'll put it that way. But this is someone who is happy in Dallas and also understands that Dallas is probably going to be where he spends the last few years of his prime. This is his best chance next to a superstar to go get another ring. And sure, it would be with a megastar once again, but there's something special about winning it twice and doing it with a different cast. It doesn't, you know, Kyrie's career was never about going and winning it as the number one option. You know, I don't think anybody has ever looked at Kyrie and said, you know, well, you haven't done it as a number one.
Right.
I think everybody has the respect for him and the appreciation for him, for the player he is, and to partner with Luka and to do it as a 1B, you know, and as a 2, whatever you want to call him, you know, for him to be able to do that, you know, if he's able to win this series with Dallas or get back to the finals, you know, here in the coming years, his prime is, you know, I think he's someone who's going to age fairly gracefully for the next few years. You know, this is his chance. And so if he becomes a storyline, if he really looks rattled, I don't expect that. You know, you've heard him in press conferences. Does he seem like a man who at this point of his career is going to be rattled by, you know, the external pressure or some boos or a fan base that doesn't really like him? Right.
Man, look, Boston is different. I'm completely with you. I think Kyrie, and I spoke to Kyrie a few minutes before game four, maybe it was the morning of game four. And I would think that was like my first extended, like, one-on-one conversation with him in a very, very long time, if ever. And yeah, he does come off like there is a greater, like nothing is going to be too big for him. Nothing is going to really get in his head. He sounds like balanced. That's probably the best word for him. He sounds more balanced than anything. And you said something that I really want to touch on before we go. As him being a number two option that people never will look at or never had looked at and said, well, you didn't do it by yourself. Like, people said that about Scottie Pippen, and there was no way in hell Scottie Pippen was going to be a number one. People said about Kobe Bryant, so he got Shaq up out of there. You know what I mean? People said that about, to some degree, LeBron James doing it with Dwayne Wade next to him, even though LeBron was the number one, and having to do it in Cleveland without Dwayne Wade next to him, ironically doing with Kyrie Irving next to him. So Kyrie is in this special place where most number twos sometimes get demerited for not being a number one. Kyrie doesn't. Kyrie is just someone who fits malleable in almost every system. You can almost picture him playing next to any superstar in today's game. You can picture him playing next to Jokic. You can picture him playing next to Embiid. You can picture him playing next to Giannis. We saw him play next to KD and James Harden, and they were a sprained ankle in Milwaukee away from winning the championship in 2021. Don't let that shit fool you. Talk about KD's toe all you want on the line. It was Kyrie Irving's ankle that derailed that season, and then the COVID vaccine and everything else the next year. But before we go, another X factor that I really want to get to, because you covered Kristaps Porzingis when he was playing next to Luka, and it wasn't even a choppy fit next to each other. It just didn't seem like the two guys were two ships passing in the night, except they were on the floor together. He's a much different, more confident player, even though we haven't seen him in a while, in Boston. And now he's going to come back at reasonable full health. Can he be the player that tilts this series one way or the other?
Kristaps?
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I think if Kristaps is at his best, this is... I don't see how Dallas guards a Boston team where Kristaps is bombing and making from 30 feet. This is a very hard team to guard. They can maybe still win the series just by outscoring them. But Kristaps and his health, his ability to, if Dallas ends up having to switch, the one thing about Boston is they can run a pick and roll with any player on the court. It's not just that they have all these defenders. Mm-hmm. They have every single player can initiate the offense. And so what you do is, Jrue Holiday, Kyrie's guarding you. Pull him up into the screen, and then you get that switch onto Kyrie. At times, Dallas is going to have to do that, have to give that up. And then if Kristaps is scoring over him just by shooting from 15 feet, kind of on that mismatch switch, that's a really hard thing to guard. I don't know how Dallas goes about trying to solve that. And so I think early on, Dallas is actually probably going to, I think in the first quarter, they're going to make him take a few shots. They're going to funnel, try to funnel Boston's offense through that, see if he's right, see what his health status is, see how he looks. I think that's something Dallas looks to do early on. And depending on how he responds, I think determines a lot of how the next few games go. Because I could see a scenario. I've seen Kristaps come back from an injury, and he is someone who can be a little bit off. And the jumper, it always looks so smooth and perfect. And then sometimes the shot's just not going in. Down the stretch of his Dallas season, that was the case. But if he's right, absolutely, this is an enormous factor in the series. And I think Boston could still win if he's not 100% or he's not playing 100% to the capability that we expect of him. But if he is, man, this is just a different sort of team, a different sort of beast to face, and very difficult one to beat.
And this is with a Luka Doncic at the peak of his powers right now. Luka Doncic might be the first visiting player to walk into the Boston Garden during the NBA Finals and get a standing ovation. They will not boo that man one bit, Tim Cato. They love Luka Doncic. I don't know why. But anyway, Tim, do you have an official prediction for this series yet?
I mean, these things are so silly because, we spent 30 yes. minutes talking it out. I've settled on Dallas in six because, and I will be the first person to admit to you, I have proximity bias. I cover the team, but I can't help but be close to them. I've seen ways that they keep winning, that at times, sometimes they win. Sometimes their wins seem almost like destiny or something, which is a huge word. But I've seen it so much. I've seen their resiliency. I've seen, certainly what Luka can do, that they have the best player in the series. I don't think the math is on my side. I think if I was, purely just predicting the math, I'm kind of leaning that way. I think the KP swing factor, I think you're 100% right. That's a huge one, but I'll say Mavs in six because, I'm over doubting this team. I'm done with that. I'm not doubting their ability to win, and I haven't even done that much of that. But even when I have, I've looked very silly. So it could be Dallas in six.
Look, I think when you had the best player, you had the best coach, and you've had a role that has hardened and sharpened you compared to the other team who might be the better team, but they haven't been tested by a fully vested roster across the way from them, and they still manage to play with their food sometimes. It's a very easy conclusion to say that Dallas could win the series. I think Boston has more ways they can win the series. I just don't know if Boston will access them because Boston doesn't take things seriously. So it's just a weird thing. But that, ladies and gentlemen, is my man Tim Cato. Thanks to giving us some of his time today. read his coverage of the Mavs on The Athletic. Don't forget, he is the host of the only Mavericks podcast wherever you get your podcast when you're not listening to this one. Anything else you got going on? You writing any books? You got any, you got any special things going on in your life, Tim?
Always got stuff going on, but nothing to promo, you know, just got a bunch of stories coming on The Athletic this week, and I will see you in Boston. If you got any recommendations, you're going to have to show me.
I'm going to take you to Black Boston, Tim. That's what you're going to be, baby. I'm taking you to Roxbury. I'm taking you to Daryl's and Slade's hanging out in Boston. You're going to have it's going to be where everybody knows your name. Tim Cato, thanks so much, man. Really appreciate you. Thanks to producer John, who's back, and the entire team who works so hard behind the scenes on this show. I'll be back on Wednesday with Tom Haberstroh for another episode of The Good Word, previewing game 1 of the NBA Finals. Until then, everybody be safe.